Okay, awesome. Welcome to the July 18th, 2020, 2023 regular session of the Board of Health. We have some additions to today's agenda. Sean Morris will present the COVID after action plan, replacing Nikki. And we will have a PowerPoint on the presentation on behavioral health programs. Other than that, do we have any additional changes? I'm just making sure we have the voting up front, so we're good to go. Commissioner Wallen has to leave at 2:30. All right, so are we good with this agenda with the changes we talked about?
I move to approve as amended.
Second time.
We have a motion, a second, to approve the agenda as amended. All in favor?
Aye.
Janet's an aye. I can see it. Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. At this time, we'll open it up for public input or comment. Just a reminder that public. Do we have any changes to, thank you, any changes to the June 20th regular session minutes?
A motion to approve.
Second.
We have a motion by Ron, a second by Melanie to approve the minutes as presented. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Public input or comment? Sorry for the tease there. At this time, we'll open it up for public input or comments. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes and direct them to the board. Is there anybody who wants to speak with us today? Anyone online? Okay, we'll go ahead and close the public comment period, which brings us to contract number 2385-48589. Sean.
Great. So this is a revision to the general terms and conditions for this contract. It's with the Department of Social and Health Services, or DSHS. And it's in light of Governor Inslee rescinding his executive order requiring COVID-19 vaccination as a condition of employment with state agencies. So in our current general terms and conditions agreement, if we were to have Island County staff working at DSHS operated facilities, there would be a COVID vaccine requirement, and this would removes that requirement, though we actually don't have any employees working at DSHS facilities. So it will renew that, and this new agreement is runs through June 30th of 2029. And we've included the complete prior agreements for record.
Are there any questions for Sean?
Has this come to the board?
It has. Yeah.
Okay.
Do we want a motion to approve or deny? I
move to approve DSHS and local health jurisdiction agreement on general terms and conditions contract number 2385-48589, amendment 1.
I'll second that.
Motion by Melanie, a second by Janet for the motion as read. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. This is the COVID after action review and discussion of improvement plan. Sean, we've been waiting for this.
Yes.
It'll be exciting.
Thank you for your patience. So we're excited to bring this report summary. This is reviewing our after action report that was conducted by public health staff in collaboration with community stakeholders who are involved in the pandemic. And so the purpose of this after action report, the presentation is to provide a high level overview of the findings, including a discussion of strengths and weaknesses and lessons learned and improvement areas. And so the recommendations we're going to be reviewing really center on the role of public health in the response and takeaways for moving forward in our improvement planning. So, you know, this report, it's coming at a time when many other health jurisdictions are completing after action reviews as part of the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Grant. And it is related to the first year of response. So public health's role in the first year of response, looking back at that time scale. So we looked at items around preparedness, response effectiveness, resource management, communication and public awareness, particularly with marginalized populations, and then collaboration coordination activities. We based our approach around the Homeland Security Exercise and Evaluation Program, or HSEEP framework. This is an evidence-based approach recommended by the Washington State Department of Health. And it provides a structured methodology for evaluating pandemic response and is consistent with other jurisdictions in their approach. So it's an approach that identifies strengths and weaknesses and then focuses on recommendations. And a bit of background. So as we all know, the COVID-19 pandemic presented a really unprecedented challenge to agencies, to governments, to health departments across Washington State and across the country that had not really previously experienced an emergency response on this scale, and in particular on this time scale, this type of prolonged response duration with an really overwhelming demand for emergency services, you know, which we of course saw during that first year. And so we had a response that needed to rapidly scale up, and lots of pressures on the healthcare systems. And so as we talk about challenges, you know, it's completely normal for this to bring up all of our past experiences for those of us involved with the response. We want to be mindful of, you know, that this can be, you know, this was a traumatizing period for many in our communities and for many of our staff and for those of us involved. So public health has resources available, and through this after action review have connected folks with resources to support wellness. And and we can pause for questions throughout as we go through. And I'll speak before jumping into findings. So the after action process we followed with that HSEEP protocol, it involved a hot wash, more of a cold wash because of the time delay, which was in a virtual event where community stakeholders came together. We had representation from Whidbey Health, healthcare providers on Camino. We had social service providers like Island Senior Resources. We had human services participation from school districts, but a number of different community members that were identified as part of the HC protocol. And so we all came together and went through a series of structured questions and open-ended questions. And there was also an interview that went out to capture more community voice and participation. And then our emergency preparedness coordinator, Nikki Meyer, and her team went through an exercise of, you know, pulling out the lessons and findings. So there were findings around that we'll speak more about here on communication, coordination, collaboration, cooperation, and responder health and safety.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Now, did you separate, because it's different on Whidbey than it is on Camino. You know, Camino doesn't have a hospital, we do. And just on your, I've read your whole packet.
Sure.
And going through it, it's like, you know, not breaking out the difference that, you know, there may have been more issues on Whidbey or on, because we had, you know, Navy to deal with, plus the, you know, the county. Well, I didn't know if you separated any of this.
You know, for the purposes of this review and to really evaluate public health's role in our key capacities, we didn't differentiate by geography. We brought everyone together from across our different communities, but certainly a number of geographical variations in response and different challenges presented. And we could bring further information that's more specific to the board if that's of interest. But no, for the purposes of this exercise, we evaluated more globally.
Yeah, like I said, going forward, you know, so that if we get this again, kind of knowing the differences, you know, what we might have to do for Camino versus Whidbey, It'd be good to know this. It's just an idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And, and there was helpful feedback that pointed to some of what you're speaking to that our team is in integrating as well.
Good.
So the first finding around communication, you know, communication is essential for effective public health practice, both internal communication between staff and across departments, and then external communication with stakeholders. And so internal communication plays a pivotal role in a number of aspects of crisis management. It helps prevent duplication of efforts. It can improve allocation of resources and timely response, reduces chance that important information might be overlooked, and improves morale of the team by minimizing confusion and miscommunication. So we did find internal communication as an area for improvement. And so looking at our internal communication processes and team collaboration and our use of tools and technology to facilitate communication among team members. And so we had some challenges in accessing, managing, and in sharing important information in a timely manner. A strength we found was around external communication. We found there was strong relationships built with external partners, and that facilitated collaboration and resulted in information flow that got out, you know, essential time-sensitive information around treatment, vaccination, testing, all kinds of things related to the response. And so we found that that external communication strength enhanced public safety and heightened our readiness while keeping partners informed on the latest developments. In particular, we found that among our local school districts and with the healthcare provider community and our long-term care facilities. And so there's a set of recommendations here. I won't read through all of them. A lot of this centers around developing and improving improved internal communication channels and strategies and making sure we can effectively use communication resources. You know, having a clear and accessible crisis communication plan, and then, you know, leveraging that technology to improve communication. Things like Basecamp, tools that came a bit more online as we progressed, but there are a number of strategies that we've been working on integrating that we will continue to work on.
I think also on, are we going to move off communication? Because I was going to make a general statement about it. Culturally within public health, this is talking about tools and there's some streamlining and there's getting information. It's really important as an organization that we don't lean in too much of, I have the information and you don't, and we become gatekeepers, that information needs to flow to everybody so that we're all equipped, right? And then everybody uses their employment lens to determine how that information applies to them and how they can use it. But in Island County culture as a whole, it's not public health specific, there is a tendency to stop information at a certain level. I have it, I'll give it out to you as it serves me. And that really did not serve the organization or the citizens. And there's a fair amount of that that has come out in this storytelling. And so I just wanted to put some voice to the fact that that doesn't make us healthy, right? What it does is make someone feel important. But empowering other people actually makes you a stronger leader and a stronger organization. And so I just, again, as we're talking about these tools and technology, a lot of it's just cultural breakdown of gatekeeping. It's just not a healthy way to do business, pandemic or not.
Yeah, that's a really important element, which also relates to the next topic around coordination.
I'm a setter upper.
Thank you.
I'm good at the segue.
So part of that, you know, transparent information flow and internal communication, really a central part of any emergency response is our Incident Command System, or ICS, and the National Incident Management System, or NIMS, which are structured organizational frameworks that we use for managing and coordinating emergency incidents, whether it's a pandemic or a response to an earthquake or flooding. ICS is designed to establish a clear chain of command and control at an incident scene. And it defines clear roles, responsibilities, and structures for managing emergencies. And a central aspect of that is the command structure and the communication flow that's part of that. So, and then NIMS establishes a common language and protocols and processes to facilitate seamless communication and collaboration. So this is something public health trains in, our Department of Emergency Management, I'm sure Whidbey Health has some training in NIMS and ICS, fire departments. So it gives us that universal language and ability to work across teams in an effective way. We did find some breakdown in what we'd consider best practices for activating and maintaining an ICS and NIMS structure that would have supported or that can support more effective coordination in the future. So we are integrating, you know, clear activation steps and clear protocols for standing up and standing down ICS and NIMS and how that's communicated and coordinated.
Shannon, do you have a question or are you just leaning on your hand?
Well, I'm doing both. Taking Jill's setup and this issue of NIMS and ICS, as I listen to you explain it, Sean, it's helpful to hear that it is a communication system that spans public health and public works. Because I think there was, and I'm going to be wrong, an assumption that incident command and NIMS sat within public works and our emergency management system. But clearly, this was a public health crisis. And, you know, one of the challenges was we had done a lot of preparation for natural disasters and other kinds of crises, and this was a prolonged, different kind of structure. So it's helpful to me, Sean, and then here's the question, if I'm hearing you correctly, that NIMS and ICS belongs both in public health and our emergency response team there and in public works and the emergency response team there.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. And so really whenever there's an emergency response, this system is kind of battle tested to be an effective approach for responding. It's the approach, you know, FEMA takes, and actually the training our staff receive is through FEMA. All new staff that onboard into public health are required to have training in both NIMS and ICS, and that's something our emergency preparedness coordinator facilitates.
Thank you.
So a strength that we found around coordination was our staff's flexibility and adaptability. You know, there was a culture of creativity and innovation. We had team members, you know, taking on new roles, and which is part of NIMS or ICS, you're assigned new functions related to that emergency response. And we did have staff effectively taking on those roles, quickly pivoting to new responsibilities to respond to our changing circumstances. And, you know, I won't go through all these recommendations. They're in the presentation and in the report. These are all items we'll continue to integrate into our emergency preparedness planning. But one or two that might be of interest. So we're looking at credentialing NIMS and ICS leadership, which are incident commander, section chiefs, and command staff. So we can have staff that are credentialed in these various capacities and really have that baseline level of ICS training, but have a bit higher level as well to layer in.
I think that what we talked about was coordination and communication and chain of command. I think at some point, the Board of Idaho County Commissioners would be interested in knowing, you know, where we fit into the pitch.
Yeah, and that's
and, something. And the Board of Health, excuse me, we're here at the Board of Health. Right. Board of Health also, for public.
Yeah, elected officials, Board of Health, really essential components of the ICS and administrative preparedness. And that's a topic that I think would be worthwhile to bring back to a Board of Health session.
And a visual. I mean, I think sometimes that visual how does communication flow and what is our roles is going to be really helpful in our in training both. You know, I remember the board saying, you know, we recognize where some of this tell us what we need to know and how we need to fit into this. And that visual is important, right? Where is the command structure? What is the role of the all elected leaders? What is the role of the Board of Health and the Board of County Commissioners? I think that, and it may be that I'm very, very visual in my thinking, would be really helpful for us to unpack in the future, Sean.
Yeah, I think it'd be worthwhile as well. We can bring that visual representation and talk through administrative preparedness.
Yeah.
And then the reassess staff levels, I mean, in talking about the talent and flexibility of all the people who were involved, there was a tendency to be problem solvers in multiple areas, which is normally a strength we value. The consequence was very few people were doing a lot of different things. And then we started burning out and we didn't have enough redundancy to kind of fill in for them. It is, I mean, I would just say that's one of those things to like train for and watch for, because, you know, aggressive, smart, talented people start filling in holes instinctively, but the same people were like, they had 11 fingers plugging holes and got to give them only 10, right? So, and some of those fingers needed to be used for their own lives. It wasn't intended to be work at all costs, right? So, okay, you're on it.
That's it,
was paying attention to the exam.
Right. I know, which I'm fine with. But I mean, also, we had regular work. We didn't know what we were suspending. You know, obviously, this was the highest priority. But again, there's also that work home life balance. There was just a tendency to overburden a few. And then a lot of people had fingers they were willing to use, right? I'm really on this damn finger thing. The damn, not damn fingers, but the damn and the plugging of the holes in the, that didn't go well. But you know what I'm saying? Like there were a lot of other people who could have helped. And I think in that reassessing staffing, really making sure that we're limiting how far someone stretches themselves so that we don't ultimately lose the person, right?
Yeah. And you've teed us up again, because a key finding of, I think it's our last one around responder health and safety and promoting a culture of wellness and relieving staff of duty. So we'll talk more about that as well.
Great.
Collaboration. So related to these other, you know, coordination, communication, but of collaborating during emergency response to facilitate an open and transparent exchange of ideas, feedback, and knowledge from diverse subject matter experts and community members is really an important part of any emergency response. So our goal is to foster an environment where staff feel safe and comfortable sharing their perspectives and working together to solve problems, brainstorm ideas, and make informed decisions. So that was a finding of an improvement area to help as we're doing as a county work on departmental silos, establishing project cycles, including, you know, the perspective of clinical staff that can all inform future response efforts. We did find with a strength with collaboration, the teams developed a common operating picture. So we had cross-department teams successfully operating mass testing, mass vaccinations, and achieving data goals that were part of that. We had effective development of logistics and clear lines of communication for information sharing and decision-making.
I want to address that for a second because in the 13 or so years I've been with the county, one of the big issues from first 10 or so was the silos we have in the department. So all the departments were siloed and they had their own universe, very protective of their universe. And COVID did force us to look outside our department and our teammates to help. And so now today, I think we have a pretty good breakdown. The silos have broken down, I think, and we've been consciously working on it. But I think having to work through COVID was really a real benefit to the organization in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the NIMS, ICS, that all helps support that you know, to work across departments.
Sean, can I ask you a question about the clinical staff and your definition of clinical staff?
So for the purposes of the report, we had feedback on, you know, getting involvement of nurse, of public health nurses involved with, you know, planning development, having that cross communication with our nursing team.
So I would include in that definition our behavioral health staff, and I know Catherine's in the room because they were frontliners as well in COVID response, both holding up our organization in some ways, as well as holding up the population that was really struggling. As you recall, we had just this tidal wave of need of people who were struggling during the pandemic. So I guess for me, I would include the behavioral health staff that were dealing with the clinical needs of our community and frankly, our staff sometimes as well.
Yeah, and that's actually my oversight here, that they were included as clinical and for the purposes of this review.
Oh, well. Good. See, you're on it, right?
At least the team is, yeah.
That's how I do.
Yeah. So recommendations, we want to facilitate a neutral and respectful conversation, or if we need to have mediation sessions to address conflicts, encourage team members to actively participate in brainstorming by developing, you know, having a non-judgmental environment for exchange of ideas and fostering a collaborative environment. In promoting information sharing, Commissioner Johnson, as you mentioned earlier, across teams and departments, so avoid that hoarding of information, but more transparency to ensure that folks have a comprehensive understanding of projects and issues. And then training and resources, which we'll talk a bit more about. And so cooperation, also a related finding. So cooperation, this really speaks to partnership and our ability to build trust and mutual support among all stakeholders, both internal and external. So this, in a response, in the COVID-19 response, involved pooling resources, sharing information, more coordination of activities, and working together to achieve a collective impact. So Our work in public health was so focused on community partnerships and continues to be in how we approach treatment, testing, vaccination, all of that. So we did find a strength around synergy and collaboration that we had common use of best practices and resources among our healthcare providers, among our clinical services, among our response staff, and that we were effectively sharing knowledge among the community. So it relates back to the strength we found around external communication so that the public could have, you know, have appropriate information to make well-informed decisions. And a lot of these are similar. It's helpful always to share team accomplishments within multiple channels, you know, celebrate wins and small successes along the way, encourage peer-to-peer recognition and collaborative team projects. We want to highlight those that are effective and regularly evaluate and improve our communication process, health and safety, and have more of a cycle of improvements. You know, we could base this off of something like a SWOT analysis, looking at strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities and threats, kind of like we're doing today, but have that more built in as we go.
So, Sean, this is where I've talked with both you, Linda, and Catherine about being a trauma-informed organization. We saw the impact of this internally and externally, and I'm certainly happy to share that information. I think those concepts definitively apply here, right? And I'm happy to share that, and you can cycle it around. But being a trauma-informed organization helps us be culturally sensitive, responsive to needs, share communication. It has many of these same concepts in how they do the metric, the organizational assessment. So I've been very outspoken about my support for using that as one of the lenses we take in preparing ourselves to be responsive in these kinds of crises.
Thank you. And that relates to our next topic around responder health and safety, those trauma-informed approaches.
Can I stop you real quick on share?
Sure.
So I was happy to see the share team accomplishments in there, because after the fact, now that we're going through this, there's really significant successes that were happening throughout the process. But midway through that process, I couldn't have described one thing we were doing right, because you're just getting inundated with concerns and fears, and you're passing those along and you're seeing the things that aren't working. It was really hard in that process to step back and say, wow, look, like, you know, we did this right and we did this right and we're doing this. And so I'm happy to see that, because I do think, at least from my part of COVID, looking through that lens, that there was some devaluing of those successes because we weren't hearing what they were. We only were hearing what was wrong.
Right.
And so I think that's a great addition, because again, we had a lot to celebrate, and it really was only after it was over that we were like, hey, look at that.
Right.
You know?
Thank you. And so this last finding around responder health and safety, we've touched on, you know, the discussion of a culture, you know, supporting staff wellness, having trauma-informed approaches, but really essential to prioritize responder health and safety during any emergency response. And also it presents a significant challenge, not only here, but in other jurisdictions. Burnout and exhaustion, we know, negatively impact the ability and effectiveness of our responders to do their work. And responders in these situations are facing extreme conditions, which can include long work hours, delegation of additional tasks, some of the whole filling you were mentioning earlier, and really just taking on an extensive scope of responsibility during what led to be a very prolonged emergency response, which was really, I think, one of the unique and defining factors of this emergency, just the scale of how long it played out. So prioritizing responder health and safety is really critical as we move forward to ensuring sustainability, and not only in our emergency response, but in our long-term public health workforce, so we can respond not only to COVID-19, but all the other needs and concerns facing our communities. And we identified this as an area for future improvement, and really, you know, looking at that extended work periods and the stressful and challenging work conditions. So we did find a strength around responder leadership. And, you know, as we've discussed, responders stepped into new roles and accepted responsibility, often without hesitation, and they're in the emergency phase during the first year and onwards. So this, you know, led to an effective response, because we had staff who were willing to provide leadership, adaptability, and take initiatives. And some of the recommendations focused on this, our goal is to develop a culture of wellness where we prioritize rest and recovery time, where that's valued and encouraged even in the midst of responding to an emergency, and having improved responder feedback communication channels to support open communication with responder management and with leadership. And some of the work we're doing around a comprehensive training program in public health, you know, that so we can train for different scenarios that we might be responding for, and have not only trainings on incident command and NIMS and, you know, response measures and countermeasures, but also training on mental health and psychological first aid and self-care and stress management, and having leadership kind of demonstrate that that will be a supported part of response. And then establishing a system for tracking and addressing concerns raised by responders, and trying to address things in a timely manner to improve morale and workloads and safety.
When you said this was a cold wash and not a hot wash, it speaks to that we didn't create that opportunity to do a critical incident stress debriefing in a more timely way, so that people weren't continuing to care or embed or bury the stress of having managed this. So I want to make sure that we don't defer giving those opportunities in the future.
Yeah. More frequent evaluation and feedback. Our teams were able to, you know, as we transitioned out of the first year and into the second year and into more endemic response, our teams were meeting regularly and there's some opportunity, but there's room to grow and lots to build on.
Thank you. I think that's true.
I think also just from my own lived experience, right? I was not hands-on, but you're literally like, you know, in the bathtub responding to people whose lives are falling apart. And it went that way for a couple of years. And during that couple of years, I don't think that I needed any respite, right? But I'll be really honest about the fact that a couple months afterwards, it was like kind of postpartum, right? Where I was like, okay, I don't know how to reengage in reality. People are expecting you to do things, but 2 years have been defined by this. You're holding on so tight, you start to let go. And that was not an intuitive process to know how to do as leadership. And I would suspect that a lot of our staff was functioning well in the pressure of what was happening. And then the minute you let go, right, we needed to be prepared to say, okay, this is what this is going to look like. And I don't think organizationally we anticipated the after fact, right? The governor declares it, makes a statement, and it's over. And like, well, but that was like 2 years of our lives that we were doing that. What just happened? How do you move forward? Is it okay to feel overwhelmed, right? Like, I'm like, okay, now we got to talk about salmon. I don't even know how to do that yet, right? And so I think that it's fair for organizationally to think through what that transition feels like for people, because I had that experience and I'm pretty average. So I figure that's what everybody else was dealing with too.
Yeah. Well, and I'll share what I shared with Sean, Commissioner, which was that I read this report after I got off work because I hadn't had made time. And then I didn't sleep that night. And I woke up and I got up the next day going, wow, I didn't sleep all night. Why? What's going on? And that happened to me during the pandemic. I had sleepless nights as we obsessed about what was our role and what are we doing and what's the health and safety of our communities. And I realized that I had moved on, but I hadn't really processed that stress, because just reading this report gave me a sleepless night. So I think that is absolutely true, that we don't always move on, or we move on leaving a part of ourselves behind because we haven't had that opportunity to really work through what that meant for all of us at all levels of the organization.
The Board of County Commissioners made a decision a few months ago that in working on our comprehensive plan update, we're going to look at it through three lenses: climate, equity, and health. And I think it's because of this thing that we went through the last 3 years. We recognize looking at our community's health is so important. And I really appreciate that one of the recommendations here is to develop a culture of wellness, and trying to figure out what that is and how what that looks like and how we can help our citizenry to do that, and our employees and ourselves with that. I'd be really interested, Sean, if you guys could put it on your tickler file to come back to the Board of Health in a year to give us some kind of update on where we are with these recommendations. Yeah. What kind of things have we implemented? What are we still working on? Not just let this go away, but let's just start working on these recommendations
and report on. We can certainly bring this back. And we have project timelines we're working on for these different recommendations. But it is definitely a national, you know, part of this response. You know, FEMA and ICS and those approaches didn't necessarily involve planning for a response on this time scale. And so bringing in this work around, you know, thinking about long-term responder health and wellness is something we're looking at here, but across the state and across the country.
I was very impressed with the report. I read a lot of it. And the one thing about it is you don't want to see a report and then it gets put in a book and gets put on a shelf. You know, I mean, to me, it's like all the stakeholders need to get a copy of this to see what you're working on, you know, so that you can get more feedback. But a lot of the stakeholders are doing the same thing. They're moving on. And it's kind of like all of a sudden this has gone behind us. And we can't do that because there could be another one coming down the pike. But I would recommend that we get this out to, you know, like I said, it's very impressive.
Yeah, and I'll give the credit where it's due. This was all developed by our Emergency Preparedness and Response Coordinator, Nikki Mayer, in her work with Taylor Lawson, our assessment supervisor. And we're working on outreach and bringing this back around to folks who participated, and definitely important to share it back.
Yeah, you know, all the stakeholders get involved with it to see, you know, that the, you know, the county is taking the lead and putting the stuff together. I think it's really important.
Yeah.
And so much of this too, outside of emergency response, is just organizationally healthy, right? How people are exposed to, there are staff that we have that are exposed to traumatic experiences randomly in the course of their work. What's our recovery and wellness plan for them, right? As information flows, how do we communicate with others? And there's just a lot in here that builds healthy organizations. And so that's really nice to see too, because I mean, I just think if you do this as a practice, that it's engaging, it's communicating, it's coordinating, it's caring, right? That's who you want to be.
Right.
All the time.
It moves us in the right direction.
Right. Right. It's great work. Ron's happy, so we're happy.
Great. Thank you.
Have you ever seen him unhappy? It's not worth it.
Yeah, best avoided.
Nice. Well, the one thing about the pandemic that when the first started, they basically got the first batch of vaccines in, and basically one doctor and myself were at a meeting, and they decided that we had to be the example to everybody that your arm would fall off. And so we didn't get the option to even talk about it.
It
was like they just rolled up our sleeves and they stabbed us.
Yeah. That's how I got mine.
That's what Dean Spierbrecher did to me. Dean Spierbrecher grabbed me at the vaccination clinic up at Camino Center, and he said, "Have you been vaccinated yet?" And I said, "No, I'm a year or two below." He goes, "You're volunteering in the clinics. Get vaccinated." And he sat me in a chair and poked me in the arm.
Just wanted to see if we have our arms fall off.
Ready or not.
That's a good thing.
Well, thank you, John, for that. And it sounds like we're interested in hearing in a year or so, like where we're at. Or so means it could be earlier. It didn't mean sure. It could be later.
Right.
We'll do. There was a time frame in the or so.
Yes. Okay. We'll bring that back.
Exciting.
Very good. Thank you.
Then speaking of jobs with trauma, now we're going to talk about Whidbey Health Behavioral Health Program update. I mean, I think behavioral health can be traumatic. So that was my segue.
Very trauma. There you go. I wish I was there to see. Is Tabitha doing the presentation?
Yes, ma'am, Commissioner.
Tabitha, it's good to not see you.
Can you not see the room?
You are all very tiny, tiny little people. It's okay.
My favorite part of Zoom is I look cute because you're this big.
Yeah, you can't see the details.
I'm sorry. It's very true.
Good afternoon. I'm Tabitha, and I'm from Whidbey Health Medical Center and Clinics. Joining me, and if you can also see Tiny Dot, Dr. Nibley. Our psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner has joined us today. Did you all get a chance to see? Okay, we have a brief and sort of high level presentation of the behavioral health services that we've been offering at Whidbey since April. I encourage you, if you have any questions while we're going through, to please ask them. I brought Dr. Nibley because she's eloquent and informed, and she would love to share with you whatever you want to hear. You can switch it if you want. So Whidbey Health is both a critical access hospital and a group of primary care outpatient clinics and a surgical care and women's care clinic. In the confines of our primary care clinics, you will find us designated as RHCs, which is a federal designation rural health clinic. As we were sort of looking as an organization to the impact of COVID pandemic and a lot of healthcare workers that had burnout, a community that was suffering from, you know, all ages suffering and needing help, we actually started throwing around the plan for what could we do for behavioral mental health access that was appropriate to a medical center and to the outpatient clinics and the types of providers that we can both employ and reimburse for in our medical setting. So that conversation began in the spring, summer of 2022. Our recruitment effort started at the end of the summer, and it took us a very long time, but a wonderful journey to acquire the provider that we do have with us. She was able to start on April 1st. And so kind of identified that as the beginning of our program, because before that, it was a year of kind of planning and hoping, crossing our fingers that we would find the right person for our rural setting, because this is truly a unique place to practice. You have to sort of be in love with what rural healthcare looks like and what a community like ours. Our island is so different. Every mile has a specialty population, and you can all appreciate that being true. Our vaccine uptake is different. Our COVID response is different. Our, you know, homeschool, private school, public school, it is all very different. So we had to find providers that found that to be a challenge that they wanted to take on. And so that took some digging. We were able to find our provider, and we worked very hard to establish access on both the north and the south end of the island. Making it financially feasible was very big. No lie that providing healthcare was very expensive during COVID. It was a challenge for our organization, just like many others, and struggling not to close our doors or limit the services that we had to offer. And you'll all recall that in the context of COVID years and afterward, not only have rural health clinics closed service lines, they've closed doors completely. So being able to open and access a new service line in this is kind of reflective of the deep value that we found and the need that we heard in the clinic with our partners and with our community. So we do offer appointments now in both Breland and Oak Harbor at clinics that we already had in place. So the Oak Harbor is the Goldie walk-in care. So you can receive same-day care on one side, and you can receive your behavioral health services on the other side. Nobody knows. You kind of look like you might be both when you walk in, I promise. But, you know, safe to walk in there. And then the Freeland Primary Care Clinic, which is really centrally located. Pediatrics Associates has a clinic right there. So it's very easy to access. And all of our appointments so far have been in person. That's due to the nature of the type of visit. And also this being a new service, we definitely have the platform and the ability to offer telehealth services. As you become aware of legislation that supports appropriate reimbursement for telehealth services, I would encourage you to support those payments, because that allows us to provide those services and still be reimbursed in a way that allows us to keep the service going.
Are you limited right now organizationally on providing services because of funding?
No.
Okay.
No. We have a deal with Dr. Nibley. She gets very cheap by Friday. No, we're not limited. We're only limited truly in the number of appointments we have available, because the need, great segue, you are a great segueer, whatever you said. We knew that our community needed this. We had no idea how fast and how rapidly they were going to hear this kind of message that this provider was here and flood the phones and flood all of our appointment slots. It's been very well received. That's a word for it. This is just a list I will not read to you of some of the different diagnoses. That's what I do. Syndromes.
Yeah, the a lot of diagnoses that from the DSM-5. You know, I see a range of disorders and mental health conditions, and they don't all fit in a nice category. So, you know, many patients might overlap with different categories, you know, trauma and anxiety and depression, different mood disorders like that. But I have seen quite a wide range of ages and types of conditions just in my three and a half months seeing patients here.
What's the youngest patient you would see?
Right now, I am approved with insurances for 13. My credentials are for the lifespan, but my personal comfort level, I'm a little more confident with the adolescents enough.
Yeah, no, 13 is a great resource to have. So thank you for that, for going down to 13.
Yeah, well, adolescent is a very important category, especially on Whitby. So felt like that was
a 13. The parents need more help.
Jeez, I thought it was going to hit 3.
Can we go back a couple slides? I had a question.
Yes, Commissioner Sean is doing that.
Thank you.
Melissa.
So with telehealth, you really can serve anywhere, or telepsychiatry, right? That's what you're really doing, or telebehavioral health, right?
Yes.
And so that can be anywhere. And then Miss, I'm sorry, her name's Miss Nibley.
Yes.
And you're an ARNP, so you're able to also be a prescriber then, correct?
Correct, yes. I mostly do psychiatric evaluations and medication management. The goal is, after I've gotten patients stable on their medication regimen, then I can discharge them back to their primary care provider for ongoing maintenance. And that keeps the door revolving so we can keep seeing new patients too.
Yeah, that makes sense. That ARNP piece is critical because it's a more rare resource to have someone who can be a prescriber, as well as understanding, you know, the talk therapy and other functions of behavioral health.
When you're saying that, I know you thought this was going to be a short presentation, but you like hit the hot button of the board, so welcome. When you're saying that you make referrals to the individual's primary care provider, are you finding capacity in that primary care physician process? So if you're like, okay, I'm going to refer you to Compass, I'm going to refer you to CMAR, I'm going to refer you back to your primary care physician. I mean, are you finding places to refer, and are those places able to pick up their patient in a timely fashion? I'm going to guess by your pursed lips, the answer is no.
Well, so there's a little bit to that because I am still fairly new. So I've been seeing patients for about 3.5 months, and I'm just now starting to reach that point where I'm getting some stabilization and starting to send them back. Many of the patients I have seen for medication management already have a primary care provider within, you know, maybe in the same clinic in Freeland or in Oak Harbor. And then primary care isn't sure what changes to make. So they send them to me to, you know, kind of tweak some medications and treatment options. So most of them are able to return to primary care, and I can communicate with primary care provider to make sure that we're on the same page there. As far as coordinating with facilities outside of Whidbey Health, I haven't had a lot of experience yet discharging them back to primary care, hoping to keep those doors open to collaborate with those providers and make sure that there's a continuity of care so patients aren't falling through the cracks.
I would be interested, not for me, it would be more of a human services conversation, to really make sure we're engaging on those timelines of especially community-based referrals. So the ones outside of the Whidbey Health system, how quickly we're getting people picked up and seen, if what we want is ongoing care, because otherwise your work is just going to be sick. You're just going to see the same people over and over,
right?
Because they can't get that care. So that'd be a good human service connection conversation.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm interested in that as well, because if you're sending patients back into the community in Oak Harbor, they may be seen, and we've got, this board has a commitment to equity and making sure that we're getting the right treatment. So if they're Spanish speaking, they may be going back to CMAR. They're kids, they may be going to Poway. Poway's now closed their practice to new patients, Poway Pediatric Associates. So I'm really interested, as you're growing your practice, that data that Commissioner Johnson's asking about as well. And then I also have a question, because in some of the analysis I've heard, the Medicaid population has some assurance, as good as it might be or not, of getting seen. And certainly folks with income and resources have the ability to get care in different ways or pay for care. I've consistently heard that the working, our working families are really struggling because they may not have enough insurance coverage, or the coverage may not be extensive enough, or they may have to pay out of pocket. They don't fit on a sliding scale. So it's that working family population that often I've heard has really struggles to get to affordable care. Are you seeing that population as well then?
I am seeing a lot of them, yes. I know less about the financial details as far as who has which insurance and how much is being covered. But I have seen quite a lot of working families and those in the lower income status because of the availability now with having me as part of Would Be Help. It seems like that has been creating more access for them to get the treatment they need.
So if I could offer some additional information around that. So if you have Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, or most private pay insurance is your Blue Cross Regencies, whatever those things. In our clinic, and because of the credentialing that Dr. Nibley has, she's seen and cared for under the same kind of umbrella of care that you would see a nurse practitioner for your regular care, for your like well visits and things like that. So most insurance, and to include all of our Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, bill that way. So it's part of, that was part of the financial plan of sustainability that we had in hiring this type of provider. So in an RHC, we can bill a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, like Dr. Nibley is a PMHNP, and a clinical psychologist. Those are the two that we can bill under the same umbrella as an MD, a DO, or an NP, or a PA. So our reimbursement is actually directed to the type of provider that's giving the care. So we're able to offer that service and the medication management, which is what we focus on. Her initial visit is longer, but the follow-up are the way you would see like an orthopedic provider before you had a hip replacement, and then you saw them afterward in conjunction with, say, your physical therapist, who's actually supposed to maintain the functionality of your new hip. We don't aim to maintain the functionality of your mental health, maybe like your talk therapy, your counseling services, those things that you would go to see an LMHC or sometimes different kind of counselors that are licensed in Washington. Those are not currently reimbursable in an RHC setting. So we don't employ those. That's not the service we're primarily trying to offer. We really are focused on that psychiatric medication management and the assessment of such. And that's why we direct the care toward returning to primary care if it's appropriate. But a lot of patients need not only primary care follow-up, they also need counseling and other referral for those kinds of services. So I would highlight, I think that's actually the greater challenge that Dr. Nibley is having isn't that there just aren't primary care. Sometimes there are doctors, but Would Be Health is expanding and has more primary care providers than we've ever had. There are not counselors that are covered by insurance. So Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, and most private insurers do not pay or reimburse very well for counseling coverage. So those 60-minute visits that you really need talk therapy for are the ones that you can't access unless you have more money. So that's actually one of the opportunities that we have in this practice is we have patients that are able to come and see for a $0 copay or potentially a $20 copay, which is very reasonable, for a 30 to 60 minute visit with our medication management provider, but seeking talk therapy counseling services, which is not what we're primarily seeking to offer. That's part of an initial assessment. But in transparency, that's not what Would Be Health is trying to do. We were trying to stabilize and do psychiatric assessment. But that is where there's definitely a gap in the continuity of care and the way that services are reimbursed and covered by your insurance.
So Tabitha, from the position of the Parity Act, which there's been a lot of, this is a policy question, the fact that the Parity Act was passed 10 years ago and we've done very little to actually meet the goals of the Parity Act. You're telling me that you're able to, with the same level of care that you would in primary care, if you're talking about $0 or $20 copays, it's the same level of care with co-pays that they would get for their physical care. So the parity is met for what you're doing. Where the parity needs are unmet still are in the additional services that might help that patient cope, come off medication, move on, the talking, other DBT, whatever it might be. But in the psychiatric med management piece, you are achieving parity with your primary care work. Is that fair?
That is very fair and a correct summary. Yes. And it's especially difficult in our 13-year-old to that 21, 25 age, because if you think you can't find a counselor for an adult, you have a very hard time finding counseling that's appropriate for an adolescent and for children. So yes, there is no parity there.
You guys use for children and adolescents, do you use the telehealth line that Children's Hospital has because their child psychiatry is so different and their med management needs? Do you guys also know and take advantage that Children's Hospital has a telehealth line that you can call into to get a secondary consult on kids?
Yes, ma'am, Commissioner, we do. They have awesome. That for children and for pregnant women and postpartum women. They have a lot of free access there, and they have social workers that can do a little bit more of those local resource referrals as well. So we do appreciate that. And our primary care providers and our emergency department providers, I would say, use those more often.
That's excellent. Thank you, Tabitha.
No, Melanie's next, Ron.
So I see Venue. That you have in January 2024 a goal to bring on a licensed mental health counselor. And I want to talk about that a little bit, about talk therapy. There's 13 participants on this Zoom call. If any of them are from human resources, you should be listening to what I'm about to say. So Island County has an EAP, an employee assistance program. And the problem, I used to do human resources here. So the problem with the EAP we have, I don't remember the name of the vendor we get them through, the Washington County's insurance, but the difficulty has always been for the EAP to have people around here that they could contract with. So I guess I would be really interested in encouraging you to have a conversation with our human resources group and see what we can do, maybe if when you're ready for that, to become part of our EAP network would be really terrific.
It's a wonderful suggestion. I will remember that, Commissioner. I too reflect if you, as Melissa, would love to change the slide. The goal, this is what Commissioner Bacon was referencing in 2024. We would love an LMHC yesterday. The rural health clinics have LMHCs included as reimbursable providers beginning January 1 of 2024. So our goal is to recruit and hopefully hire an LMHC that would start by then. That would make those visits reimbursable in our RHC clinics. However, in full transparency, it's a loss, a money loss provider either way, because their visits are so long per day that you can't actually have enough of them to make up for the cost of your provider. So at Whidbey Health, we consider this sort of a community benefit provider, where we hope that we both don't lose a lot, but we don't expect to really make a lot either. But we know that this is a necessary service, especially in conjunction with the rest of the behavioral services that we're offering. We are actively recruiting for another PMHNP and for an LICSW, which are both reimbursable right now. So if we were to find appropriate candidates, which is really the trick, we've had some, they really need to be the right one for our community. If we could bring those on right now, we would, I'm sure, have full caseloads. And I don't want to say it on a recorded thing, but we're full until January of 2024 with new patients to be seen by Dr. Nibley. So that's a long time. I told her last week she was the most popular provider Whidbey Health has ever had. I don't know that she appreciated that as much as I appreciated telling her, but
it's not me, it's my profession.
Yes. So we do recognize that this is, I mean, truly critical. And this is one part of what we need to offer. It's a good first step, and it really proves sustainability and prove to an organization that has limited resources ourselves that this is something our community needs. So our goal is to grow it, to be able to offer lifespan care. We would love to be able to offer children in addition to adolescents, but we need to make sure that we hire the right provider who can do that service.
I was going to interrupt, but it's your turn.
My turn. Well, this has been a long time in the process. You know, we've been concentrating on getting the mental health out that we've got to do. We had to stabilize the hospital, which we've gotten it stabilized now. We're, doing a lot better financially, so we're able to, provide these things. And that's been a really primary goal is recruiting. We've got to recruit more. But it takes money to do that. And so, like I said, it's nice to get that point where we're able to start doing it. It's no matter what, no matter how much money you have, it's hard to recruit. It really is. And so that is a real high priority for us. So.
You mentioned that there's a loss of revenue in putting some of these additional services out to the community. Do you know what that dollar range is? Are you like a $10,000 a year loss, $100,000 a year loss?
Between those two.
Excellent. I got that math too. I should have been more specific.
You'd have to get the CFO. You have to get Paul in here to, basically there's so many things going on right now. And like I said, our priority is to get them up and running and add to it.
No, I understand.
But we do have that on the books. If we had Paul in here, he could tell you exactly what it is.
I mean, I'm only just thinking about the different, I'm sure we all are, thinking about the different boards that you sit on that have behavioral health funding streams coming in. And so my thought process is, well, if it's 90% paid for, what's that additional 10% cost? And is there crisis revenue that you can use? Or, we get different funding streams going through for Medicaid patients. It's really Medicaid patients, but subsidizing the service to Medicaid patients might be that 10%. And so that's what I was trying to understand is how far we are from standing this up within the healthcare system. Because that's really the single point of entry that integrated care was supposed to be about. It turned out to be about financial integration, but they sold it as human care. This is the actual model. You walk into a clinic and it's like, I have an infected toe and schizophrenia. And you get treated as a single human with lots of different varying issues. So this is the ideal model. I was just trying to think through the funding shortfalls and how you leverage that out to get the dollars in there, to get the care in the appropriate spots, right? This is the ideal scenario.
25 to 50.
Okay.
How's that?
Better
than 10 to 100.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. It is starting in January because that's when we can charge for them, period. It's not reimbursable before then for an LMHC. In an ideal reimbursement situation where we sent out a bill and an insurance company paid the bill, and we all know that doesn't happen all the time. In an ideal world, we are not at a functional loss for a PMHNP at all. We are closer on a clinical psychologist. They come closer to breaking even or making just a little, and the functional loss really comes on any provider who needs a 60-minute visit all the time.
Sure.
Just the limited number of minutes that you can fit into an 8-hour working day is the reason why.
Okay. Good information.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic question. Dr. Morris asked if we get a flat rate reimbursement for physician level services. And the answer is yes and no. Medicare offers the same rate. Medicaid offers a rate that they determine annually, and it's based on a complicated calculation they did on purpose that way, so that it's hard to figure it out, but it's based on how expensive your providers are at your clinic, and RHCs are reimbursed that way so that you neither are profitable and everyone's buying yachts, but you make enough money that you don't have to close your doors. So it's meant to reimburse you so that you can stay open and operating. It's not meant for you to lose money. Private insurers are independently negotiated rates between Whidbey Health and that insurance company. And private pay, of course, is something I don't know. I could come back if I do another presentation and find out how many patients we actually have that have private paid for these services. And just to address the sliding scale idea, we know a lot of other public agencies will offer sliding scale payment. Whidbey Health can't offer that because we're a public hospital district. But what we are required to offer as a public hospital district is charity care. And so charity care is available to every single person who comes to either the hospital or to one of our clinics if they meet certain income guidelines. And there's kind of proof around that and a form to do. And that's required for us, everyone that works for Whidbey Health, to know that and to offer patients. If we were to see someone that said, I'm paying out of pocket, we would say also, please fill out this charity care application and talk with our financial team. So no sliding scale, but we do have charity care. And that's mandated by the state and being the kind of hospital that we are.
How many additional patients do you think you could see with the LMHC?
That's a fantastic question. The nature of those patients tend to be longer term patients. So your absolute would be whether or not we'd have to mix, which is what we've done for our PMHNP, weekly patients, monthly patients. Those are our, you know, maybe a 3 or 6 month check, but they're more stable and it's really just a check-in. And currently and down the road, you know, a year from now, someone who was seen and stabilized by the PMHNP team would still be followed up in 6 months or a year because you still need medication management to make sure what you're doing is okay. A counselor is not going to adjust that. They do not have prescribing ability. So it really depends on the amount of patients that we accepted and the frequency of their need for counseling.
So they would still need to go back to the doctor then if they're getting stabilized through the counselor, but you'd still have this one, you have still the singular prescriber.
Until we can hire more, correct.
Right. Yes. You're getting expensive now, Tabitha.
You know, 5 years in, it's when my price gets higher. Yes.
So you have this one page, you have this list of conditions and dysfunctions. And one of the bullets is substance related and addictive disorders. And the Board of Island County Commissioners gets hit up a lot by citizens wanting us to do something about the drug. So I'm just wondering how much of your work Dr. Nibley is dealing with folks who have substance-related and addictive disorders?
That's a great question. I wish I had put together something to really count how many. There's a lot of overlap. I am of the belief that trauma is the gateway drug, and substance abuse usually happens after a traumatic experience or series of experiences. So oftentimes I am addressing the substance use and abuse as part of the treatment program. I'm not doing, you know, in a 30-minute appointment, I can't be, you know, going over really heavy duty substance abuse issues that they might be needing. And that's when I would refer them to like an inpatient facility, somebody that can monitor and help them, you know, wean off of them safely. When it is not as much of an addiction issue and more of a coping skills, you know, just trying to find a means of escape, I can do a lot more work with them in reducing their use and helping them get off of those substances more safely, usually by treating their disorder more appropriately rather than self-medicating. So that one is a little bit more difficult with this island and the population. And as I'm learning, you know, being new on the island with this group of people, you know, some of the services that are available and the gaps that we still see. And there are still gaps with substance abuse.
Are you working, you as a collective you, I'm not expecting you to, working with human services as you expand this program to help identify those provider gaps? And again, we're primarily working with the Medicaid population, but the gaps in that system are probably very similar to gaps in all insurance systems. And so I wanted to make sure that there was knowledge coordination happening to make sure that we're learning from your experiences. Because if I'm sitting here, I'm like, well, you just refer those individuals to the ITUA center. They go in there for involuntary stabilization and then they'll find them a bed. That's what I think is going to work. And right. And you're shaking your head. So understanding how that system works is really important to know where to put pressure on for greater investment. right?
That's right.
A great commitment out there of legislative leaders, local leaders to get investments made in mental and behavioral health, chemical dependency, but it's hard to always know what part of the system to expand or where there's just an absolute hole and nobody's doing it. And so long-winded coordination would be really important for us to understand.
And I'd echo that. I think to Commissioner Bacon's question, I've heard the need for more short-term detox beds. We do have short-term detox beds through our crisis stabilization center. If you're seeing that, it's good information for us to have in our system of care and in our advocacy and policy work. As are the payment differentials, Tabitha. You know, we know that TRICARE, TriWest, Medicaid, and Medicare pay cents on the dollar for the cost of delivering services. So I'd love to know that data just in this area as well.
That's good. I know the data for that on some other services is 22 cents on the dollar. I don't know that to be true for this. I will find that number. Happy to share it with you.
Yeah.
If Catherine had unmuted or if Linda wants to comment, Would Be Health does participate and has been since before. Catherine, do you want to unmute and respond to that inquiry? You can tell us if we're useful or not as well.
Very useful. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes, we've been meeting with Would Be Health and Tabitha and her team prior to her Would Be Health hiring Dr. Nibley and have been involved in this entire process. So I think it's been an excellent collaboration. And we continue to collaborate regarding need. Did that answer the question?
It did. I actually knew you had those meetings. Wanted to maybe emphasize the importance of them. And then
thank
also
you.
Really just like out loud say how exciting it is to have the hospital mm-hmm. as a participatory partner in this care for behavioral health patients. It has been challenging to not have that partner because, again, most people think if something's wrong with me, I go to a doctor, right? And then they immediately think of Would Be Health system. With behavioral health being outside of that system, it's really made this process harder for the community, harder for the treatment model. And that was a big gap that it's exciting to see filled. And so, I'd like your schedule to not be so booked up, but it also just speaks to the importance and significance of this kind of care. So it's this very exciting report for us.
Thank you, commissioners and board, for letting us present. It's exciting to be able to have this discussion. A long time coming.
Very exciting. Interested in understanding funding gaps.
We'll work on that. I know people will get that information to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's hard.
Yeah.
That one. It's not
going to get better. Oh, man. Now, Sean.
Yes.
You are going to talk to us. That was a really, we've had two good presentations.
Yeah.
Now, we've got some wildfire smoke prevention measures you want to talk about.
Yes.
Melanie,
I will speak about this for a bit, just with smoke season potentially on the horizon. We have predictions of an above normal potential for wildfire smoke, August, September, maybe, for most of Washington, parts of Idaho, Montana, so a lot of the Northwest U.S. We have a lot of available grassy fuels, hot and dry conditions expected throughout the summer months. And so as we've experienced from the smoke the past few years, we know that wildfire smoke can exacerbate different health conditions. It can have, range from minor to severe impacts. We mostly see higher impacts in folks with pre-existing conditions. So when smoke is present, we can also have impacts to healthy people, can show how show problems. We also see long periods of wildfire smoke impacting mental and behavioral health. just, you know, having going through wildfire smoke brings up feelings of going through kind of disaster, going through, it can be isolating, limiting time we spend outside and engaging in activities. We can have feelings of isolation from staying inside for prolonged periods of time or lack of sunshine. And so we're working with on community communication and helping prepare our communities if we're to see this kind of impact again this year. And so prepping for mental health and physical health both are extremely important. Mental health, some of the strategies we know work, you know, having building up social connections, identifying now maybe someone you might ask for help or someone who may need your help if we have a prolonged smoke event. Checking in with loved ones throughout a wildfire smoke episode. And when we think about steps to stay healthy, so if you have or, you know, a chronic lung disease or respiratory infection, existing heart or circulatory problems, such as congestive heart failure or coronary artery disease, that can have increased risk when we have unhealthy air levels to sensitive populations and above. People under 18 are more sensitive, lungs and airways still developing. And then folks older than 65, more likely to have unrecognized or diagnosed heart or lung diseases. And then folks who are pregnant and outdoor workers. And we also see greater impacts to our lower income populations. They're more likely to have higher exposures and are less likely to have the access to healthcare, be able to afford interventions like HEPA filters to reduce exposure. So you can stay up to date. We're sharing out resources on our social media and on our public health website, on our environmental public health pages around forecasting and smoke preparedness steps. There's the Washington Smoke Information website, also known as the Smoke Blog. And the Department of Ecology has the Air Quality Washington Forecast Atlas that can give locally specific information. And so yeah, we recommend everyone to kind of stay up to date on current and forecasted air quality, limit duration and intensity of outdoor physical activity when we have that unhealthy range. And it is best to stay indoors in the unhealthy range, knowing that health impacts really are variable and specific to different individuals based on their unique circumstances. If staying indoors, ideally, you know, because this often coincides with high heat, having air conditioning, but that's not available to everyone in our communities. So you can, you know, take some steps to stay cool, like keeping windows, keeping curtains over shades, keeping windows closed and using portable fans, minimizing use of stoves and cooling off with a cold shower, using ice packs on feet, or dipping feet in cool water can help cool down, staying hydrated. You know, if you you can also go out to a cooling center. In Washington, the 211 line is up to date with cooling centers, and we're sharing that information out on social media and on our websites. Skipping sugary drinks like soda and alcoholic drinks can also help avoid dehydration. For prolonged times indoors, it's also worthwhile to check carbon monoxide monitors, just to make sure that that's up. You have sensors in place whenever windows are shut and we're spending more time inside, but throughout the year. And, you know, N95 or other NIOSH approved respirators can filter out smoke and fine particles. You know, even bandanas, it's different from COVID, you know. Other types of masks can, bandanas can filter out some smoke particles, but N95s are the best. You can find those at hardware stores or home repair stores and pharmacies. And we have some we're working on distributing out to our community members. And then really quick to also add pet safety. When we have unhealthy levels, it's best to keep pets indoors as well. Keep outdoor bathroom breaks short. And for livestock who have to spend their time outside, limiting their exercise and having plenty of fresh water available located near their feed or hay, you might consider soaking hay to reduce inhalation of dust particles. And livestock might need a few weeks to recover after a poor air quality event. So you might want to check with your veterinarian about how to monitor animals and returning to moving and transporting them if you're in agriculture. So any questions about smoke preparedness? We are also working on sharing out some HEPA filters we received from the state with child care centers and senior centers. And we're working on getting, we have instructions on how to make your own box fan DIY filter, which is a bit more affordable. And we have community outreach workers who can connect folks in with like the WIDBI Essential Needs Program and other grants that are available to help get HEPA filters and preparedness items. So. Yeah, this will be in the next Health Matters as well.
I think LNI is coming out with some rules on that too for outside workers on requirements that, you know, it's not just carpenters, but it's road crews, anybody out there. If there's a smoke level, you're going to be required to have, I don't know if you looked into that one, but yeah.
There was a recent release of rules of Washington State on heat. For outdoor workers, haven't seen anything related to smoke exposure.
I heard about that. So you might want to check on it because we don't want to get any of the county employees in trouble for being required to have a mask on when they're out working.
Well, they'll love that.
And just put Jill Johnson's name and home phone number on them.
Sean, the Northwest Clean Air Agency has their purple air sensors as well as their big air quality mapping, and that might be also worth sharing so people can know where to go to get the air quality, because we have these weird microclimates and there are purple airs all over our county.
Great. Yeah, we can share that out as well. Thank you.
It's interesting to think about if we had a prolonged smoke incident. I mean, there was a couple of years ago, we had a period of time where, you know, we got phone calls of should we shut down outdoor swimming? Should we have the soccer matches? Should we? It does seem like the earlier conversation we had about our response to the pandemic could be scaled to a point that if you had a major smoke event, you could use that as a practice kind of model, because there's a fair amount of communication in there. Businesses need to know what to do with their workers. Community members need to know what to do. We would potentially have distribution of masks or different types of things. And so it does seem like a small scale but significant model that you could practice that on, right?
Yeah, it's great. You do an ICS training, incident command.
A lot of the smoke right now is coming out of Canada. Can you charge them an impact fee?
Yeah. Right? We do have a cross-division team that we've developed to address air quality. I think includes human services folks as well. But yeah, that's a great idea.
Can you clarify? I'm trying to remember who has authority on closure of events, because I know that's a bit of a politically hey, Howard, good to see you. A politically charged, Ellensburg has faced that in wildfires with the rodeo. And so I'm just trying to remind myself who has authority to close events, and Howard may know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't know, Dr. Libran, if you're aware. Let's take a crack at it.
Okay.
I do.
You're going to shut it down for us?
Well, I can either take the recommendation of the state or make that recommendation myself, or I can actually issue a closure order.
Yeah, that's what we want to hear, that we can blame you. And that sounds like the perfect answer for us.
It's been quite an interesting conversation in other counties when this has occurred. And it's tough. We've not faced that in Island County in my memory.
You know, and you look at the other side of the coin, and you have groups that have come from sometimes all over the state to participate in a soccer tournament, for example. And, you know, they're filling all the local hotels, and then you tell them that they can't go outside and have their game. I can see why it's a political issue. And I don't have any way really of punishing them. But the circumstances may, in fact, do that. And that would be very uncomfortable and very unfortunate.
Yeah.
Everybody involved.
That is why we're thankful that you are the decision maker and we can hide behind you. We appreciate you bearing that burden for us. That is a gift that you give. Look, I'm always going to be like, I didn't make that decision. I'm so sorry. I'm a victim of his choices. That's awesome. That's like the best news of the day.
Yeah.
The helpful thing this wildfire season is DOH has a set of guideline recommendations for public health action as far as following levels. And they have released a set of outdoor activity guidelines for adolescents that are recommendations, but we have guidelines to go off of, which is new.
Yeah, that's a good document to share too.
So Ron has to leave at 2:30, sure. And he also needs to get an RSV vaccine. So can you tell him what he needs to do here?
Yeah, so we have some recent recommendations from FDA and CDC on RSV or respiratory syncytial virus vaccination for older adults.
That's you, Ron.
And I don't know if you recall, we brought information around this triple-demic last cold and flu season where we were seeing lots of RSV, particularly in infants, leading to hospitalization. So this is that virus often presents in healthy adults as, common cold, but it can lead to severe disease and complications for folks with pre-existing conditions or are immune compromised. So what this recommendation, it's for a vaccine from Pfizer and GSK for people over 60, and it uses a shared clinical decision-making approach. So that means you'd go to your provider and talk with them about the vaccine and your unique health factors and make an informed decision of whether the vaccination is right for you. And we are seeing review of childhood RSV vaccination, no recommendation on that. The data review is taking place, but there is an FDA recommendation on a monoclonal antibody shot to protect infants and vulnerable toddlers. That is really the first protection available to all infants and toddlers that will be available this fall. So those are some updates we're seeing to hopefully have a healthier cold and flu season this year.
I was raised to always say women first, so you get the shot first.
That's one of the things. My granddaughter, who was 7, was hospitalized 2 years in a row in ICU with RSV when she was a toddler. So I'm very grateful to hear that there's some forward movement on that one. So it's very scary.
Yeah. Impacted. Thank you.
And now, Sean, before we go, I have a question about mosquitoes.
Okay.
So we're seeing some malaria in the south. It's not an issue that's up here, but mosquitoes definitely are up here.
Right.
I have a question about these water retention ponds that we require. It happens in the city more than rural areas, right? They do these water collection ponds on site. Every development has to do it. They have to hold their water. It percolates, goes into the system. Public health knows all about this, I'm sure. It's probably there's interjurisdictional recommendation. But I'm curious about how those retention ponds impact that mosquito population, because there's this water correlation. And I just drove through a new development yesterday, so this is what got me all fired up about this. And then I have that same equity component about intense development, a water retention pond, which attracts then the mosquitoes, which are, malaria kills more people than, I think it's like a big world killer, right? It's like one of the number one killers in the world is malaria. I swear that's a true fact. Okay, everybody's like, I knew what I was talking about. And so I had a question about public health's role in that conversation of tension around, this is what we need to do for on-site water retention, cleaning it up, very important. At the same time, there is this potential public health ramification of attracting these types of bugs and then the diseases that they carry. And then again, from that equity lens, in more populated places, are we requiring this? Because people aren't doing retention ponds on 5 acres, right? Have you given some thought to this?
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Did you go through that development yesterday?
Yeah, what's going on there? Like you said, we've seen some now, I think, confirmed endemic malaria cases in Florida. And so part of our work in environmental health is monitoring vectors like mosquitoes, looking for those species that we know can carry malaria or Zika or West Nile virus. So there's that ongoing tracking piece, but this idea of a kind of a One Health topic of thinking about unintended consequences from, from water and causing increases in the mosquito population is really interesting. If I could take it back to the team and workshop that, we're thinking about bringing One Health related topics to the board.
Yeah.
And I think that would be to bring Chris Matochi, our living environment supervisor, who's involved in that work, and our EH staff. But it's something I need to discuss with the team.
It's really like a one-off problem, right? The water retention is probably the driving problem we're facing. But as the climate changes and different things, if we're building in solutions that create consequences, it'd be good to have some recommendations around that, I think. But I'll let the professionals think about it.
Yeah, we want to limit any habitat for vector-borne disease like that can support mosquito populations. So that's really interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
I have one thing. There was an article in the Seattle Times today. I forwarded it to Sean, but I think I'm going to put Dr. Liebrand on the spot if he has any information. Dr. Liebrand, it's about the Washington has lost about $2.5 million through federal cuts that will hit childhood vaccination programs and immunization data tracking efforts, both of which state officials say grew during the pandemic but are now at risk of crumbling. It says the losses could result in incomplete reporting on vaccinations, which will likely mean less informed and less equitable public health strategies, the state solution said. Are you familiar with this or have any thoughts about this?
No, I am not familiar with it.
More to come, I'm sure.
Yeah, yes. I know it's mostly going to impact. So that was federal funding that was slated for the Immunization Information System, or IIS, which does relate to vaccine availability, but it's how we track data. It relates to allocation of vaccines for our childhood immunization program. And the CVP, your childhood vaccine program, which is a really key way that uninsured patients access childhood immunizations. Most in commercial and Medicaid insurance, they fully cover childhood immunizations. So it's really a safety net program. So we may see some impacts there, but really kind of time will tell to see the extent of this impact. There is new funding from the legislature going out to health jurisdictions for vaccine outreach and promotion efforts. So we see some funding in other areas. I did a quick look at our immunization data. We had a dip, particularly in the kindergarten population during the pandemic, but we're almost back to, we were on 88% pre-pandemic for being up to date, and now we're at 87.7. And our overall youth childhood immunization rate is fairly stable. It's around 90%. It's a little bit above the state average. I don't remember the exact number. So
what's the herd rate for childhood vaccines?
I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to research.
It depends on the disease.
Yeah.
A number that's often bantered about is 80% for measles, for example. But it's specific for East disease, and it's also specific for different demographics, I guess you could say. Just like the infectivity of coronavirus varied, and that because of that variation, it was really hard to tell anybody what the herd immunity required would be. And it's the same with the individual diseases, although with common childhood vaccinations, we know that information. I just don't have it on the top of my head.
I just remember the measles outbreak in 2018 that started in Clark County and moved all the way up as far north as Snohomish County. So it was knocking at our back door. And I think the legislature then enacted some legislation on vaccines in our schools. And so it's just information I think it would be good to know, so that as Sean talks about rates, we have a context for that.
When we were doing the COVID vaccine, we did get to a point where we could see vaccination penetration in different populations to know who was consuming the vaccine and who wasn't, so we could target our outreach efforts different. Mm-hmm. For childhood vaccine, do we have that same demographic breakdown to know, is it, you know, to understand, are we reaching all the populations? Do we need to design our messaging different to penetrate some of those areas or, you know, income levels? I mean, again, I just think if I was working two jobs and had a kid, vaccines would be the last thing I was thinking of until like a school said you had to get it, right?
Yeah. We're able to track that through some of the Medicaid data dashboard has some of that information in IIS. I think that's one of the concerns with this funding shortfall, that we might see some impacts to our ability to track health equity and target interventions effectively. Yeah.
Interesting. Does anybody else have anything interesting for the good of the order? Or the not good of the order? All right. Well, then if there's nothing else, we will.
I just remembered that I did have something, and it was because we were focusing on mental health. The Stanwood Camino Area Foundation has spun off a separate nonprofit that is going to be focused on mental health. Catherine, I think, already knows this, is going to be doing mental health, sort of a SWOT analysis, and then how to begin to deploy some investments and work with local partners on the mental health needs in the Stanwood Camino community. So I thought that might be of interest to the board.
Interesting and exciting. Well, I'm glad we integrated behavioral health at the Board of Health, because it's obvious that they are interrelated. So we'll give ourselves kudos for that decision. And if there's nothing else, we will adjourn what was a very interesting meeting. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.